I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. John McComb joins me now. The veteran broadcaster signed off in mid-December 2019 after a distinguished career at radio station CKNW, some 36 years there, and a total 50-year career at radio stations in his native Arizona with stops in Montreal, Portland and Montreal. But it was those years here in Vancouver that put his mark on the conversation of the day. He was a reporter at CKNW and became the first reporter from that legendary newsroom to become a talk show host. He's remembered for his famed pairing with Philip Till and The World Tonight that became The World Today when they moved into the afternoon drive slot in 1997. Eventually, Till went to mornings, and eventually McComb followed him to the morning drive slot. When he announced his retirement late last year, it was said in a news report that he had a book in him and a podcast. I'll ask him whether he's gotten writing in a moment, but there is a podcast, the aptly named John McComb Podcast, dropped shortly. And as we look ahead to that endeavor, I'll get Mr. McComb to reflect on a long career in broadcasting and news. Perhaps he'll indulge me in reminiscences of former colleagues like Till and many others that we grew up listening to in this town. Incidentally, the day before he signed off in December, John did an interview with Drex that I thought was just terrific. Hearing two fine broadcasters reflect on the medium of radio. John's podcast will be available on all platforms. One gets a podcast, Spotify, Google, and so forth. It will deal naturally with the issues of the day. So I'll ask John what's on his mind as he sort of eases out of retirement. The Twitter handle is at JohnMcComb980. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John McComb. Mr. McComb, good morning.
Joe, thank you for having me, and let me just ask you a quick question before we get started. I'm going to turn the tables on you here. What is it about the radio business? What is it about people in radio? Because you've interviewed virtually all of them. What's your attraction to do this?
I guess it's because I sort of thought I wanted to do this when I grew up. And so I grew up listening to NW.
Yeah.
My mom was a nurse. And so, you know, it's a station that you listen to in an emergency.
Right.
I used to be a commercial on the station. So as a kid, I listened to NW. I like Sinatra, so it was easy to listen to Cullen as I drifted off to sleep at night. And then, you know, as I grew up and, you know, became politically interested, I listened to the talk shows, you know, David Berner at midnight, Rafe in the morning.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I realized after a while I didn't want to do it anymore. It's a terrible business, isn't it?
Well... If one of my kids asked me, I'd recommend doing something else. But
and so it's fun to get to talk to people like you guys who I listened to growing up.
Yeah, well, you do a great job, and
you're very kind to say so.
I've learned a lot about my colleagues by listening to the interviews that you've done over the years. So congratulations on that. I'm sorry. Now, what was your question?
I guess retirement's over for you, isn't it?
Well, to an extent, I lasted 10 weeks after retiring on December the 13th, and my short-term retirement goal was simply to sleep in.
Right.
And after about 8 weeks or so, I'd managed to get my circadian rhythms back in proper order, and I got a lot of sleep, and I felt just a heck of a lot better. But then I was feeling good and feeling, you know, like I got some energy back and feeling strong. And then I thought, geez, I've got nothing to do. So some friends of mine, Dean Maley and some of the folks that that Dean is partnered with, gave me a call and said, you know, we talked about this before I retired, but how'd you like to do a podcast? And I thought, yeah, that's something I think I could get my teeth into.
But do you miss the job, though, this morning show that you did? I mean, soon Simi Sierra will be hosting it permanently.
Yeah, congratulations to Simi on
indeed.
That. It's fantastic.
Great choice, yeah.
I don't miss the hours. I miss the people. I mean, it's a cliche to say, but it's true. I miss the socializing with Nikki Reitmeier and with Greg Schott and... before she left to go to Edmonton, Pippa Reed, and it was a great core group to work with, and everybody had just a tremendous amount of fun. I missed that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The broadcasting, well, I'm kind of doing that on the podcast. You know, I have a little studio at home and all the equipment and stuff, so I don't miss or I haven't lost talking into microphones. There isn't much that I miss about it. You know, I mean, hell, I did it for 50 years. I'm doing a smaller, much smaller, tighter version of it now, because I've found that podcasting is a heck of a lot like doing radio segments, really.
Yeah.
So I don't miss the overall bit. I'd put in my time. I'd put in my half century, but I do miss seeing the people who work, you know, behind the scenes, and the producers and the technical people. There's some great folks at NW.
I was going to say, because I followed you in, listening to the afternoons, and then mm-hmm. when you went to mornings, and you know, I listened to everything. So I go back and forth between you and the public broadcaster. I noticed when you went to the mornings, you mentioned some of the people that you worked with. They're a lot younger than you are.
Yes.
And something changed, and I don't know if this is accurate, but you'll tell me. There was a certain energy that you got from them. I mean, I remember, you know, going ghost hunting and playing. Well, you didn't play hockey, but the others played hockey, you dressed up as a pirate, and you captained a False Creek ferry. I mean, doing stuff like that. I mean, that's stuff that you probably wouldn't have done with Till, maybe.
No. No, but that all started actually when John O'Dowd came on as my producer. And John is from Ireland, and actually went to school for radio and broadcasting and journalism, unlike a lot of people in the radio business. So he came over on a work visa, mm-hmm. and he just started coming up with these ideas, and I thought, yeah, let's go with it. You know, obviously, he's a guy in his late 20s, early 30s. You know, Nikki's 30-ish, and they just brought a completely different, much more energetic, much more fun dynamic to the program. Because before that was about a year and a half after I started doing mornings. When I first started, the show was kind of, we were still trying to find our way. You know, it didn't have a lot of direction, and there were some growing pains, I think, and we had to say goodbye to some people and bring other people on. And once O'Dowd came on, it was we were off to the races. The show went to number one in our demographic, and John just did a hell of a job, and it was his idea to go out and for me to captain the little passenger ferry that mm-hmm. runs to Granville Island. And as soon as I took over, the thing died, and we had to be towed back into the dock. So that made it lent the show just an air of fun outside of the show itself.
Right.
So I think that's when we really started to take off a bit.
And yeah.
John has since been promoted to be the executive producer, so he's done well. But yeah, that's when it started.
Yeah, and so it felt. I mean, it still worked, but I mean, it felt fun, didn't it?
It did, because as well as being a good ideas guy, I think John brought a sense. He gave the show a sense of direction, I think. And it's, you know, people will say, well, yeah, but it's your show. But the fact is that the producers do have a fair amount of power. So when I come in at, I used to get there at 4 in the morning, the last thing that I wanted to do was dismantle the show and rebuild it by mm-hmm. the time we got to 5:30. So there's a lot of inherent trust that goes into a relationship between the producers and a host. And I got to the point where I just I trusted John implicitly, and off we went. So
coming into this world of podcasting in those several weeks of retirement, did you find yourself reading the paper, watching the news, say, and seeing certain things in
yes.
the news, and then it made you want to come
yes.
back? Yeah. What were some of the things that you were thinking about that you wanted to talk about, say?
The blockades, you know, the native protests around the Wet'suwet'en, the blockades, initially just the unbelievable, and I really learned something, just the unbelievable amount of BS that was floating around. You know, I hate to use the term fake news because it's a Donald Trumpism, but people were jumping to all sorts of conclusions that just were not based in fact or based in reality. So that really kind of got my attention. And in fact, my first podcast episode is with a fellow named Chris Sankey. And Chris is a native businessman up in Prince Rupert and a big, big supporter of oil and gas. And he says that the people who've been out doing the blockading and the radicals, as he calls them, know basically squat about the Wet'suwet'en and you know, what their heritage is, what their background is. Obviously, the native people involved do, but whenever you have demonstrations right across the country like this, and I said this as soon as it started to happen, I said, this is going to attract every Tom, Dick, and Harriet who has a bitch against the federal government or the provincial government or the police or the system or the man or whatever it is, people are going to be attracted to these protests. So you ended up with tons of people who had no idea what the original issue was. You know, well, we support the natives. Yeah, great. But, you know, do some research and approach this thing with integrity rather than just jumping up so you can shut down an intersection somewhere. It seemed kind of ridiculous to me.
And so how long are the episodes? And these guests phone in, I guess, right?
Yes. I've only done two. I finished my second one today. So I talked to Chris on the phone. The first episode, I think, is about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. The second one will be about a half an hour, but it's basically just me talking. We'll see how long that lasts. But it's issues of the day, but it's also, I think, a place where I can stretch out a bit and, you know, look back over 50 years and tell a few stories and talk about who I am off the radio, because I think there's a certain, when that red light goes on, whether you are having a good day or a bad day or you feel great or you feel like crap, when the light goes on, you're on. And so you have to develop a certain other persona that takes over, that kicks in, and it becomes like second nature. With the podcast, I'm able to be, I suppose, a little bit more myself, be a little bit more frank and honest about, you know, my life, because I've had a very interesting, very interesting life, and I want to communicate some of that to the audience, because I think a lot of the things that a lot of the challenges, shall we say, that I went through starting from very early childhood to adulthood are things that people can relate to, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who are going through the same kinds of things. And it has to do with mental health. It has to do with depression and anxiety. But there is a deeper background to why I ended up with depression and anxiety at, you know, as a late teenager in my early 20s.
So we'll talk about that in a sec. We'll talk about your background, but just back to the current events and having had the career that you have in terms of years.
Yeah.
When an issue like the Wet'suwet'en blockades comes up, it's easy for those of us who follow the news to wonder what's going to happen or how this story ends, if you will.
Yeah.
And I'm sure throughout your career you've seen similar stories, maybe, or you might have an idea from history how this thing turns out. Right now, did you have a sense of where we're headed?
My sense of this is, I mean, here's what happened. Because I covered the original B.C. Supreme Court hearings in the Delmagook case back in the 80s as a reporter. Then, of course, it ground through the system, and it wasn't until the late 90s that the Supreme Court took the case, looked at it, and essentially reversed the lower courts, the appeal court and the B.C. Court, B.C. Supreme Court. And said, yes, native title has not been extinguished. Thus, you know, it exists. I think the problem and why we are at where we're at today in terms of the protests and everything is that nothing really has been done on the part of the Canadian or BC governments to directly address that issue of traditional territory. They've talked around it. They've spent lots of money doing other things, and they've tried to make it, you know, reconciliation. And you know, so I think Canadians were kind of led to believe that, well, the governments have this under control, and Native people, you know, seem to be accepting, except for, you know, the odd place where they want to run a pipeline or something. But I think what happened is that finally, after 23 years, the Wet'suwet'en in particular said, no, we have other issues that have to be sorted out first. Because if you look at this agreement in principle that they've signed, it has nothing to do with coastal gas, nothing to do with pipeline. It has everything to do with traditional territory. And so this is kind of, to me, this is kind of the reckoning. It's like, okay, and the feds and BC have not laid out exactly what the deal is. But my sense of it is that we're going to, pretty soon, we're going to wake up to a much different situation in the North in terms of land rights, treaty rights, all of those things that have kind of been shunted aside. And the first thought that I had that I hope this doesn't happen, and this is just me, you know, pontificating, but I think the development of natural resources in British Columbia in the future is going to be, could become very, very, very difficult. If it isn't difficult already, unless there is a huge change in attitude, it could be non-existent. And that's a tough thing to say, because this province still relies on natural resource development as a key driver for the economy.
When you would sign on in the morning to do the show, and issues like this would be at the top of the news or something that everyone talked about, did you feel behind the mic that you had influence on how people would think about a certain issue, say?
Yes. I mean, I don't think you can do, well, either the afternoon or the morning show on CKNW and not figure that you are having an influence on the way people are thinking. I mean, that, in a sense, that's part and parcel of the job. You know, people used to send me emails and say, why don't you just deliver the news as it is, instead of commenting and making, you know, assertions and what have you? And I would write back and say, well, because in my contract with Corus Entertainment, it says that I am a talk show host. I have opinions. I am to express those opinions. And I'm not a journalist in the usual sense. And that it indeed is part of the job to have opinions. And so I know that I affected people, because they would write in and tell me. Somebody, oftentimes they'd write me and tell me I'm full of crap. but other times people would write in and they'd say nice things. So, yeah, I mean, you obviously, you know that you're having an effect on people.
How often would it be where your own opinions would be changed as the story evolved? And not just the story evolving, but I'm sure the influence of the people around you, say?
I don't want to say quite often, but it certainly did happen. I mean, it's like anything else. The story begins, and you begin to tell the story, and you're not sure of all of the information because these things play out over time. And so, I mean, I've been around long enough that it's, you know, I can almost take a template and say, oh, yeah, this seems like that story, or mm-hmm. this has the hallmarks of other stories. But, yeah, once in a while, when new information came in, and that really is the key, if the information changes, if there is, better, updated information, it allows you to understand in a much bigger way what's going on. So your opinion, unless you're just a hard ass, and mm-hmm. you know, which a lot of American talk radio is that way, your opinion is going to shift slightly one way or the other, because if you're a thinking, rational person, that's the way it's supposed to work.
When the Trump phenomenon started, I mean, that was something that nobody could have foreseen or had seen before. That's not a story that America had known before, right?
Not in my lifetime.
Yeah. So I mean, when you think, I mean, we're coming up to an election in November, probably a topic that you're going to be talking about on your podcast. Mm-hmm. How do you explain what's happened in the United States in these last three and a half years or so?
I'm probably the last guy on the planet to ask that question of, because when Donald Trump first announced that he was running for office, this would have been 2015.
Around there, yeah.
I laughed my face off and said, this guy doesn't have a chance of not only of not getting the Republican nomination, he'll never get elected president. And as the Trump supporters in my audience love to tell me over and over again, that I, you know, obviously you're full of BS because you didn't see this one coming. And a lot of people didn't. I think a lot of people, a lot of media people, a lot of commentators and writers didn't understand the full brunt of the amount of anger that existed in the American voter, and also against Hillary Clinton. I mean, she won the popular vote by 3 million, but you know, that's not the way they count them down there.
Yeah.
But I think it was a matter of Trump just being Trump, and the way he one by one he picked off all of those Republican contenders, making fun of them and putting them down, and he still does it. And,
yeah.
To me it was so childish and so schoolyard, but it sure did attract and convince a lot of people. And this time I don't think I'm going to say he'll get elected, and then maybe he won't, because my prognostication skills are terrible. But if it comes down to him, well, it'll come down to him, and I think Joe Biden. I don't know that that Bernie is being an avowed socialist might be a bit tough in the U.S. But if it comes down to Biden and Trump, or Bernie and Trump, Trump's got every shot of winning again.
What worries you about sort of the discourse and how that's coarsened over the last 3 or 4 years?
No, it hasn't coarsened. It's become there's a chasm between the two sides, and that's very much Trump's doing, because that's the way Trump thinks.
Does it make it hard for you to talk to an audience?
No, it didn't make it hard. It's just that I don't think in those kind of black and white terms, and that's what, well, figuratively and literally, that's what has happened in the United States, is mm-hmm. that there is a chasm that hasn't really developed in this country as much, but in the U.S. there's a, you know, forget bipartisan, forget working together. You know, if Trump is so in control of the Republican Party that if he tweets something about a fellow Republican who's pissed him off, you know, that guy, that person's reelection could be in jeopardy. So everybody's lying, because I hear this over and over. Where is the Republican Party?
Mm-hmm.
Where are the moderates in the Republican Party? Where are the people who of Ronald Reagan
or Barry Goldwater?
Barry Goldwater. Nope, everybody's lined up behind him.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a very interesting, I think, election campaign.
Well, one of the areas that I thought you were most effective on the air was when you did talk about mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
I know Rafe did it before, and Sheila Rogers, obviously. But there was something about the way you talked about your own battle with depression and anxiety that I think had quite a poignant influence on the audience. You took time off. Was it 6-7 months?
7 months, yeah.
Yeah. And then you came back and talked about it, which I think did a lot to take the stigma off of it.
Well, I wasn't as heroic as it sounds. I had a real tough time back in, leading up to 2004, I guess. But I'd always wrestled with depression and anxiety. Anxiety especially, I think I had from the time I was a little kid. And then went through a growing up period with a wildly dysfunctional family, lots of trauma, lots of mayhem and nonsense. So by the time I got into radio when I was 17, I'd pretty well left the house. When I was 16, I came home one evening being out with friends and found that my mother had died on the floor of the living room, apparently trying to get to the telephone to call for help. And I came in and found her. And at that point, my childhood, my young adult phase came to a screeching halt, and I was basically on my own, because my dad was around inconsistently, shall we say. So 16, this happens in October. By the next June, this will be June of 1970, I'm 17 years old, still going to high school. And I'd been interested in radio since I was a 10-year-old kid, 8-year-old kid. And they'd opened up a new FM station in Tucson that was at the time was called a progressive rock station. So it was right up my alley, mm-hmm. you know, playing all the music that they weren't playing on Top 40 radio. And, I started doing the all-night show, petrified, absolutely petrified. I'd open the mic to do a top and bottom of the hour ID, and it was like, thankfully I got over that. But the mental health thing kind of stalked me for all of my professional life, really.
Yeah, and so was it around that time, to 2004-ish?
Mm-hmm.
When you took that time off, that it really came to a head that you had to address it at that point?
Yeah, because I had been in a kind of a downward spiral, and I think the problem was that one of the issues was this perfectionist streak that I've always had. So, and Phil Till had something to do with this, although I don't say that pejoratively. Phil Till had been one of my big heroes, and I'd never met the man. I listened to him on NBC radio, you know, loved his writing, you know, awards for his war coverage and all that. And then the next thing you know, he's doing the evening show at CKNW, and I'm reading his news on his news, on his show. Well, he strikes up this, he wants to strike up this relationship with, you know, the host and the newscaster, banter back and forth. And so we did, and then he came to me and said, well, you know, you should do my vacation time when I go on holidays. And I said, oh, no, man, this is NW. There's the newsroom, then there's the talk shows, and they are, you know, never the twain shall meet. Well, after a fair amount of lobbying, I did finally sit in for him. And I just had this, instead of relying on and going with the talent and the capabilities that Phil saw in me and other people saw in me, I thought that everything, I felt like I wasn't good enough, that I really had to ratchet it up. And everything had to be perfect, because now I'm working with Philip Till, you know. It's like, so I dumped so much pressure on myself for months and months and months and months. So I'm already suffering from depression, already suffering from anxiety. I'm beating myself up mentally because, of course, nobody's perfect. I'm self-medicating with alcohol. Many of my forebears were alcoholics. I didn't become an alcoholic, but I did do a fair degree of significant drinking, yeah. So all of that together kind of coalesces in 2004. To the point where, and I've told this story before, I was having panic attacks on the air. You know, when I was reading the news, I would set up the newscast so that I had pieces of sound, like either a reporter, voicer, or an actuality, a sound, that I didn't have to read too long before I hit the sound so that I could get my breath back, because I was hyperventilating. And I've been in the business for like 33 years.
Yeah.
So now it looks like my entire career is passing before my eyes because I'm having panic attacks. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. I'm disassociating. I mean, it was just brutal. And I thought, well, if anybody finds out about this, I'm done. Forget about it, you know. So finally, I wound myself up so tight, and Phil knew this, that one day I was sitting at my desk, and I thought, I just can't do this anymore. So I went next door and talked to my boss, Ian Koenigsfest. I said, literally that. I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm coming apart. And he kind of shrugged and said, okay, well, get a note from your doctor, go home, get better, and when you're better, come back. And it was like somehow the universe opened up in front of me, because I was so petrified of anybody finding out that I was depressed. And come to find out, you know, every other person is depressed, right? So, but at that time, I was sick. I really did need a break.
What did you learn about yourself in that time?
Well, the big takeaway for me was that, because I was convinced that I was done, and even in my own mind, I decided, you know, this isn't for me. I've got to try something else. So, as I got some rest and took some long walks on the seawall and walked through the forest and started thinking about, what do you want to do? I thought, you know what? I've been at this a long time. I know how this thing works. I know I'm good at it. I just need to get off my own back. I just need to be me and just roll with it. I had to change my perception of who I was, because I tied my self-identity so closely to the job. I had to find a way to break away from that and look at it differently, and I did. And so I went back to work after 7 months. Till and I were put together. I forget what the arrangement was, but we did afternoon drive and just had a ball. Just had the best time. Some of those shows with Phil, you know, the crying out louds and all of that stuff. We used to just crack each other up. It was so easy, and the chemistry was so good that it's right up there with the best fun I've ever had on the radio.
So when you guys were put together for the first time, that would have been in the 90s sometime, for the World Tonight, right?
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah. Was that a fast, because of the relationship on the air? I mean, we still hear it, you know, when you know, you guys would get together in the mornings, or he'd drop by.
Yeah.
You couldn't sell that. I mean, I'm sure program directors would want to sell that. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That sort of chemistry that you had. Yeah. What was early on when you first started? Did you guys hit it off right away?
Well, as I had a man crush on Phil because I admired his work so much, when he first came to town. The first thing I did was invited him out to our place for dinner out in Maple Ridge. This is before Michelle and Annabelle, his daughter, and his wife and daughter, even made it over from France. Uh-huh. So, or from London, sorry. They were in London at the time. So Phil comes out for dinner, and we just, over a couple of glasses of wine, we just hit it off. It was like instant friendship.
Yeah.
And I was really quite knocked out by, actually, when I got to know the man, I found out what a jerk he what an ass he is. But in those days, it was all great fun. And we still, you know, we still get together. We have coffee probably, I don't know, a couple of times a month. And it's just like, it's the same old shtick, you know.
Yeah, I dug up this Danny Boyd column from 1997, and you know, he talks about the history of, you know, egos at that station.
Yes.
Hoping, when he met the both of you, that it would be the same thing, but, you know, quickly disabused by that because you guys actually got along.
Well, and this was the other thing, that Phil was, in a way it was surprising, but now that I know him, it isn't. Because talk show hosts in particular, but radio hosts tend to be pretty protective and pretty territorial of their time slot, or anybody else coming in and maybe, you know, giving them a run or what have you. Till was not like that at all. It was his idea that I do his fill-in, and it just flowed from there. So he, there was never any ego involved. And to me, I found it so refreshing, and I was so blessed to have a partner who, we used to, before the show, during the summer, we'd go out in the parking lot, across from the arena, Rogers Arena. We used to play Bool all the time. You know, we'd sit. Those days are gone, by the way. We'd sit in the office and watch Days of Our Lives, put our feet up and watch Days of Our Lives that came on at, I don't know, two, I think, and then go and talk about it on the air. I mean, it was just that kind of relationship that we fell into. But, no, he's still probably my best friend.
Yeah. Now, would you indulge me if I rattle off some names and then you give me some thoughts of the people that you work with? Like, I've already mentioned Ralph Meier.
Yeah.
You spoke beautifully at his funeral.
Thank you.
What was he like? I mean, the guy that was on the air, I mean, he was that guy off the air too, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't to me, and this is one of the things that you remember Al Davidson, the famous NW sportscaster.
Big Al, yeah.
Big Al had this big, gruff, don't get in my way kind of way about him, but never with me. And the same with Rafe. Rafe was, I don't know why, Rafe was a big fan of what I did. And he was as encouraging and as helpful and as, you know, with advice if I ever had, you know, questions or what have you. Yeah, come on in. The thing that attracted me to Rafe, two things. Number one, his being so upfront about his mental health problems. And number two, and this is something that I learned from him that I really took to heart, is his apparent lack of fear in going after the powerful. I just admired that so much that he didn't care whether you were the prime minister or he had the premier in there. I mean, he would go at them hammer and tong. I always found that impressive, and I tried, once I got into that side of it, I always tried to think, how would Rafe handle this? You know, I've got the premier coming on. How would Rafe do this? And, we became good friends, and he has a special place in my heart because I learned a lot from just listening to him.
And, you know, I read the paper, I watch the news, and think of what he would have thought of, you know, even like the Wet'suwet'en story, you know, where he would have come down. I mean, he was unpredictable in that sense too, wasn't he?
He was, and he kind of mellowed a bit later, before he left NW, which was an absolute shame, ridiculous the way that whole thing ended. But I think he was an environmentalist, you know, and so I think he would have been very, very much in this conversation that we've been having.
So Rafe, I've done this about 1,800 times now. Rafe was I think, at this point, the most frequent guest I've had on. He's been on like 10, 11 times. Someone who came on early on, mm-hmm. Was just a lovely guy.
Yeah.
Gary Bannerman.
Gary Bannerman, yeah.
Did you have many interactions with him?
I didn't. I was, in those days, we were the newsroom. The main station was still out in New West at 8th and McBride. And the talk shows were always downtown. So that was that was in the era of, you know, never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, you could go for months and months, a year, without seeing, you know, Bannerman or Barry Clark or any of those people, because they were all downtown at wherever the studios happened to be at the time. So I didn't really interact with Gary all that much. I thought he was a hell of a broadcaster. But like a lot of people in this business, I think that he dealt with the pressure with alcohol. You know, because, you know, people will say, well, it's only a 3-hour show. You know, all you do is talk. How can that be? But the prep and the pressure to get it right and be right, you know, all of that stuff, it can be a very, very taxing way to make a living.
Yeah.
I think Gary found that as well.
Now, when you went to mornings, you weren't doing the show that Frosty did, but did you talk to him? Did he give you any advice as to how to handle the hours even?
Well, I certainly didn't ask him for any advice about what the show should be, because I could never in a million years do what Frosty did. He was just the funniest dude on the planet. And so I wouldn't even think of asking him for advice about that. Yeah, we did talk about the hours, and when I took the time off for my depression thing, he was actually one of the first people to call me and say, you know,
yeah,
we're with you and hang in there, and was very, very, very supportive. Yeah, I think we had a conversation about the time, and he said, "Yeah, you'll never get used to it. You'll never," he said, "I never did," and he did it for, God, how many, decades,
yeah,
and decades.
Yeah.
And I used to talk to Willie Percy a lot at Rock 101, and he said the same thing. Yeah, you never get used to it.
Yeah.
But, no, Frosty was the best. I just loved listening to him in the morning.
Yeah, I have tapes of him, and I go back, you know, once a year or so, just to hear the pattern and how he'd cut to a commercial, just so beautifully, and again the wit, just how sharp that wit was.
Yeah, he was one of a kind.
Yeah,
he used to have. I remember there was a time that Frosty would have like a 22 or 23 share of the audience, and this was before the internet, before iTunes, before any of the other places. And he'd have like a quarter of the entire listening audience listening to him.
Yeah.
He was so good.
Now, Bill Good, I mean, I, you know, was a great newscaster on television and on radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he left NW, but, you know, he's still active in the business. Was that sort of, I mean, you weren't going to disappear like Frosty did? Or...
No.
I mean, you said that even, that you were going to write a book and you were going to do a podcast after you left, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm too, the reason I left NW and left the morning show was that I was exhausted. I had a bit of a episode, I suppose, in October of last year that kind of got my attention. It wasn't heart-related, but... my doctor put me through every conceivable test on the planet. So no heart issues, you know, nothing physical. And I thought about it and I thought, you know what, this feels a lot like, in a similar sense, how I felt back in 2004, just that kind of mental exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm over 65 and 3 o'clock in the morning is a very early time to get up. So I just thought, you know what? I've seen this movie before and I don't want to go there. You know, I've got enough money stashed away to live, you know, fairly comfortably for a while. And, that was one of the reasons that I just thought, because my goal was to go to June of 2020,
mm-hmm.
June of this year, because that would have given me exactly 50 years in broadcasting. But I was talking to Phil about it, and he said, "Man, what are you doing?" He said, "First of all, whether it's 49 years and 6 months or 50 years, nobody cares." And I thought, yeah, you're probably right. There I am, you know, setting the bar at some point where whether it makes any sense or not. But I just decided to hang them up, and here I am talking to you.
And I mean, will you be selling commercial? Will you be doing commercials like hearing aids and things like that, or foldable beds and like some of these other former colleagues that we see on TV all the time or listen to on the radio.
I see Tony Parsons every once in a while. He's selling something.
Yeah.
It's not, I still have some spots running on NW, some endorsements on NW. In the not too distant future, I'm going to become the voice of the radio imaging voice for CKNW. So that'll keep me busy.
Mm-hmm.
I've got my podcast now I'm doing some work with Lori Pinkowski for her website. So yeah, I've got enough to keep me going for now. But you know, Bill ever gives up selling mortgages, you know. I know who to call.
Whenever I talk to people like yourself, because it was 17, 16, 17 that you went into radio, mm-hmm. could someone 16, 17 years old today expect the next 50 years to turn out the way that your career did?
It's impossible to say because I very early on in my career, I got to work with some great, great people. With huge amounts of talents. What they were doing in Tucson, Arizona at the time is beyond me. But so I learned from real pros. And since radio was the only thing that I really ever wanted to do, that it was always my focus. I don't know that a person who's entering the business at this stage, if they're just going into radio, I think it's a bad idea. I mean, you have to be now so completely versatile. Before I left NW, they'd installed this suite of video cameras, and people were, you know, Global is talking about using, you know, radio segments
simulcast
on the TV and what have you. So a person these days getting into broadcasting, you have to be versatile with social media, with video and audio, and editing that stuff, and you know everything that goes with it. It's just become a huge. So when I hear people say, "I want to get into radio," I go, "Well, yeah. 50 years from now, it's going to look a hell of a lot different."
But people, you know, talk about how. You know, audit is to me, one of the channels here runs the CFAX morning show, I guess, on the TV.
Yeah.
You think that's weird, but I mean, you know, Imus did that for years on MSNBC. Going back to the early days of television, Arthur Godfrey was you know, just as big a TV star as he was a radio star. So, I mean, these things are cycles, I suppose.
Well, and I think part of it is just, to me, it always seemed weird that because radio is... tends to be a fairly intimate medium, because when you're listening to the radio, you can be doing other things. You can have it on in the background. Mm-hmm. It's companionship for a lot of people. TV isn't like that. You have to focus on the TV to see what's going on. So I always thought there was a pretty big separation between radio and television. And one of, talking about Frosty, one of Frosty's great talents was that they take publicity photos.
Right? Mm-hmm.
He would never want his picture taken because he didn't want people to know what he looked like, because it was all part of the theater of the mind that he created every morning on NW. So he didn't, and he wanted to be known as Frosty because that was the character.
Right.
But now, of course, with so many different platforms and so many different ways of getting news and information and entertainment. Radio and TV are merging, and Global's just announced this big online app that they've come out with that you can watch shows at any time, watch the news at any time, and that's what people want. You know, they want it now. They don't want to wait around for, you know, the news at the bottom of the hour or what have you.
At 16 and 17, were there people on the radio that you admired, that you sought to emulate even?
Yes. In one of them is still a very good friend of mine, a guy named Terry McDonald, who was a disc jockey at the local AM rock station, and another guy who later changed his name to Shadow Stevens. And Shadow Stevens, another great guy, great announcer, just wildly creative. He left Tucson to go to Boston and worked at WRKO, then went to KHJ in Los Angeles, and then left there and was at KRLA and some other LA-based radio stations. But he was a gigantic talent and a nice guy. Terry, too. Terry ended up doing a tremendous amount of voiceover work. He owned a recording studio in Seattle, did a lot of voiceover work for National Geographic Channel, Discovery, Washington Post, just did a whole slew of. So those guys were the guys that I really looked up to, in town. And, you know, guys who would let me, as a 15-year-old kid, let me hang around and, you know, press my nose against the studio glass and watch what was going on. And I remember Shadow invited me into the studio, and, you know, it was like, oh, my God, you know, I'm here at the Nerve Center, man, and watching him work and, you know, queuing up records and all that stuff. It was just, you know, for a 15-year-old kid, it was just like in Nirvana, you know. Yeah. So they were, you know, they were very kind and you know, kind of showed me the ropes very early on before I got into the game.
Well, one of the things that we've touched on already is just how competitive the radio business is. And I was going to ask you if radio is still relevant, and it obviously is, because, I mean, the station that you used to work at, the public broadcaster, I mean, it's a very competitive business. They all look at ratings. Do you think we as citizens, we as news consumers, are well served by the news gathering in this market?
What's happened? I think generally I would say yes, but what's happened is, of course, like when Frosty was doing the morning show, the overall ratings, the overall audience size was huge. 600,000-700,000 people. But what's happened over the years is that's compressed. So now the total audience might be 300,000. So it's more difficult for radio stations to go out and sell advertising, sell time, because than it was back in those days, because essentially you're selling half the number of people. That leads to efficiencies, and Chorus Radio is nothing if not efficient. And so they've combined the NW newsroom with the Global newsroom out in Burnaby. So the amount of new stories, I think, has probably gone up just because of that interconnectedness. When I left, I wish we had, you know, more reporters, and I wish we had. But it's, you know, it's always that way. I thought that way back when we had everything, you know, back in the '80s and '90s and into the 2000s were really the heyday, the golden era of CKNW. And even then, we bitched and complained about. I think we had a 30 or 35 person news department, which is gigantic, and we'd all go, we should, you know, wish we had some more people, you know. And management would roll their eyes and go, what do you mean, you've already got 36 people. I think that's inherent in the business, that
it's never enough, is it?
People like to bitch and complain about things. Sandbag.
Well, I cannot tell you, this hour has just whizzed by. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you coming in to do this. Our friend George Garrett was has urged me for a while now to talk to you. And I, again, cannot thank you for doing this, and I'll look forward to the podcast.
Joe, I appreciate it. I've been aware of your work and your presence over the years, and I appreciate having the opportunity to come on and talk to you, because I have a lot of respect for what you do, and you've talked to so many people that I'm wondering when your book is going to be out.
Well, when's yours? I mean, Garrett had a great success with his book, I'm sure.
Yeah. All of the podcasting stuff is kind of, because I started to write.
Yeah.
I wrote the first chapter, and it's still sitting there on my hard drive. I'll get back to it at some point.
Well, you know, you shouldn't wait too long. I think that's what, strike while the iron is hot, or whatever the phrase is.
Yes.
The John McComb podcast is available on Spotify and elsewhere. Follow John on Twitter at John McComb 980. John McComb joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.